listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Regular viewers of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk, may have noticed that there hasn't been a new edition for several weeks. We caught up with the program's host, Peter Lavelle, who is close to the end of his mandated 30-day vacation. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Wednesday.
Under the Russian labor code, it is obligatory that a full-time employee gets 30 days of vacation a year.
A month.
It's
dang.
Obligatory.
Wow.
They force you on vacation.
Wow.
you don't have a choice, okay? So I've done my 30-day stint.
Everybody gets 30 days.
I'm free again.
There you go. Free to go back to work. So let's start with this piece that I saw you posted at on Facebook from the American Conservative. Why Trump's approval numbers won't budge. Robert W. Murray wrote it and says, despite a horrible week, and they talk about Manafort pleading out and the lawyer Cohen with the problems he's got, he's still polling relatively high, and it's because the fight is bigger than just him.
Well, you know, just before we started our conversation here, I looked at a few clips from MSNBC discussing actually the same issue. To their bewilderment, what is wrong with the American people? Well, what they don't understand is that they don't understand why people voted for Donald Trump. They voted for a vision of America that Trump presented. And it has nothing to do with marginal figures, because To the chagrin of the mainstream media is that the American people, by and large, have figured out that all they want to do is take down this president by any means necessary. It has nothing to do with what he says or what he does.
Right.
And I think that if the mainstream media, particularly on the left, did focus on what Donald Trump primarily does, then there would be some issues to discuss. But because they're in the weeds all of the time, and they can't see the trees from the forest of how the American people feel. And I'm not carrying water for Donald Trump now, not at all.
Right.
You and I could talk for hours on end and go issue by issue, and it would be a 50-50 break in many ways, maybe even more negative to some of the policies of the president.
Right.
But that's not what his base looks at.
Right.
And on top of it, everyone, I think, that voted for Donald Trump knew he wasn't a choir boy. It's baked in.
Right.
Okay. I mean, here's a guy, a billionaire, and he was able to attract the attention, let's put it that way, because this is a PG plus, 13 plus radio. You know, some attractive young women that were quite notable in like men's magazines like Playboy. And I can tell you a lot of people in the heartland where I come from and say, wow, I wish I could have been able to do that. See, right. It's not a negative, okay? And they didn't vote for him on morality. They voted for him on very specific issues. Jobs, the wall, and ending foreign adventures, military adventures. I mean, it's really quite simple.
Yeah. Yeah, the, you know, for me, there were watching the you know, the things that came out of his mouth over the course of the election cycle. I was kind of mystified when I first started him take the positions that he did on foreign policy. You know, here in New York, we know Donald Trump, and you know, I'm somebody that's been active in dealing with development and housing, and you know, these kinds of issues locally, like regionally in New York, metropolitan New York area. Donald Trump, as a developer of large projects, sometimes we were on opposite sides of the microphone at public hearings and things, or his people, and on one side and me and ours on the other, you know, as an adversary. This is a guy that's, you know, going to come in and he's going to build this gentrification-inducing project, and it has to be stopped at all costs, and blah, 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 blah. But looking at his foreign policy, I assumed it would be conventional Republican foreign policy, and instead he starts with, well, maybe NATO is an expense that we don't need, and it serves no purpose because the enemy that it was created to address is gone. Obvious, it's absolutely true, by the way, and obvious to any observer that is looking at it honestly, but unspoken and almost a sacrilege to say it, and it was treated that way. Likewise with the ideas of, you know, the whole R2P thing, the right to invade other countries and to, you know, bring them democracy and build them a nation. And nation building and the whole regime change thing. He said basically that is bad. Then the whole, you know, on the one hand, you know, he's America first and America is a wonderful country and all of that, which is what they all say in one way or another. But he also admitted, this is another thing apparently that was a sacrilege, when they said, well, Putin's a murderer, Bill O'Reilly. He said, well, a lot of murderers. Yeah. Do you think our hands are clean, too?
Yeah.
You know, so these kinds of things coming out of his mouth were novelties in the public discourse. And I was surprised to see at the RNC that they resonated with the Republican base there.
You know, this is what makes it really interesting. Again, let's look at CNN and MSNBC. They like to portray everything that's going on is that it's a open-minded, tolerant left, as opposed to a closed-minded, bigoted, backward-looking right. They get this all wrong because for the very reason what you just said is that Donald Trump has challenged some of the pillars of the orthodoxy of America's hegemony in the world.
Right.
That's what Michael Morell and people like that, you know, former acting director of the CIA coming out, Clapper, Hayden, all these other people, this is sacrilege. You cannot question these sanctimonious pillars of American foreign policy, and that's what got him in a lot of trouble with the media, because the media is the sounding board for foreign adventures. They've never disliked a war. Okay, it's always great for ratings. Okay,
right.
And all those beautiful missiles. Okay, that's a gravy train for them. Unfortunately, on this very recent topic that we're talking about, is that I see Donald Trump actually buckling. the deep state. Look, the rumors swirl, though you won't find it on MSNBC and CNN, that the U.S. may be planning another strike on Syria. You won't see that anywhere, okay? But what was it? MSNBC for an entire year did not even mention the crisis in Yemen.
Right.
That is American-backed, funded, logistics provided, etc. PR cover, etc.
Right.
Okay, not one word over in the course of an entire year. How many Stormy Daniels stories did they give you?
Right.
Okay. So, but let's go back to Mary's article. This is something that really has put a lot of pollsters into a quandary, because as he points out in this article, there was this a coalition of the ascendant. It was going to be minority groups. It was going to be women, sexual minorities, immigrants. This was a growing coalition that would forever move the needle of American politics. And you and I, on this edition of your podcast, and we can do it for time infinitum, but, you know, can we ever really trust the polls anymore?
No,
okay,
no,
because
no, no.
They really dug themselves a pretty deep ditch in 2016.
Right.
So the point is that I'm much more conservative, and this is what I tell people, is that I don't like dividing people up into boxes, okay? Should we necessarily assume that an African American woman is a Democrat? And I think this is something that we have to wake up to in the wake of 2016. I mean, is it correct to always put people in boxes? Because when I think of politics, I think of policy and I think of values and principles. When you have all of these strategists for the GOP and the Democrats, they're looking at totally different issues, okay? And that's why I think that there's a misreading of the electorate and of the population in general, is because the punditry class is looking at the wrong things, constantly looking at the wrong things and looking for a political advantage instead of looking objectively what's going on. And I think if you objectively look at what's going on, you'll get a different reading. And that's why I put that article by Mary on Facebook, because I think it's a fascinating way to look at looking at politics.
Yeah, I agree. Some of the things they're talking about, this ascendant force you're referring to, for example, you know, the belief, according to the author, is that this would usher in a new era of globalism,
right.
Open borders, identity politics, free trade, cultural individualism, foreign policy interventionism, and gun control. And first of all, I think it's a fair statement to make that this was the belief, but and because I think this is the package that was being sold, but there is nothing intrinsic in any of these elements that necessarily ties them to another. In other words, the idea of cultural individualism and identity politics, those two things seem, you know, related, but they don't necessarily relate to open borders. Au contraire, you would think that instead borders would be kind of hardened around these individual, you know, identities. Globalism and gun control. Well, okay, if the United States is going to practice gun control, doesn't it sell more arms around the world than everybody else combined? You know, there are things that are contradictions among each of these elements, and yet the belief is, and the package was being sold, that they all go together. The reason for that, of course, is that there's an elite constituency that benefits from each of these elements that have reached, and perhaps membership is the same, you know, among that class for all of them. So this is, we make money on each of these things, so go sell them.
Yeah, but I'm not in that club.
Right, exactly.
And so, I'm not invited.
And so, exactly, the people that are out here supposed to buy it, some of us, however we come to it, if you come to it from the right or the middle, I come to it from the left, say, you know what, that's not for me. Okay, I don't think that we should be doing foreign policy intervention, for example.
That's my very point, is that if we just took all of the elements that you just mentioned, how many people are actually, all of them, right, all of those elements, how many people are fit all of them at the same time?
Right.
I don't think all that many.
Right.
Okay. Look, globalism, whatever that means, and that's something obviously the elites promote because it's to their advantage. I don't think the average person really knows what that means. But if you talk about hemorrhaging jobs, the lack of border control, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm so far away from it, Don. But you know, the whole hoopla about separating families at the border. I mean, I just couldn't get my head around that. That's been going on for decades. It just didn't happen.
Right. That's right.
Okay. Number two, and this will maybe disturb or upset some of your audience here, is that, well, if there was a wall there, then nobody would get separated. I'm sorry to sound so simplistic, but that is true.
Right.
All right. I mean, I've known many, many people in my life in a variety of countries that have gotten citizenship in a different country because they went through the rules. They went through the process. It's not easy. It's work. It's paperwork. It's money. Sometimes you need a lawyer. But they do it legally, and I have, and I'm absolutely open to that. And I'm going to sound like Bob Dole yelling at kids on his lawn, you know, like get off the grass, you know. But I think every country needs to have an immigration policy based on merit. Well, this is not the 1890s. It's not the 1900s where you just needed brawn and numbers.
Right.
We don't need that. We need smart people. Okay? I mean, they should set up a huge visa center in China and in India. We want all of your mathematicians and physicists. Okay? We're going to help you. We need this kind of intellectual muscle. All right? Because I taught at the University of California for a number of years. I'll tell you, again, I'm going to call it straight here. A lot of middle-class white kids just don't like physics, don't like chemistry, don't like math, okay? And every single institute across academia that has studies at the end of it should be completely disbanded because you're not creating workers of the future. You're creating whiners of the future, okay? Sorry,
you know,
my little rant before I go back to work tomorrow.
And of course, people should understand you are actually an immigrant in Russia. You're an American that now lives in Russia, and you went through the rules.
I have to go through all of the rules here, and there's no exception. They don't pamper anyone. You know, I mean, the thing is that I think, and that's a criticism I have of immigration in Russia, is a lot of people want to come here, but they don't make it easy.
Yeah.
And if you caught overstaying your visa, God help you. Oh, my God. Yeah. See, this is the difference, as I always tell people, is that you're left alone by the state, but if you get into the Russian criminal justice system, God help you, okay?
Yeah.
Because it's not nice. And so, that's why most people keep their nose clean, because you get into the system, they mark it on your papers. Anytime you want to get a job, they know where you can't lie about it. It's there, all right? Mm. That's a deterrent in itself, okay?
Yeah.
You can't hide from your past.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that galls me really here, the things that are driving people to, you know, rush to the border, at the, you know, the southern border, in particular the United States, and also the airports, because folks coming from Middle East and Africa, are wars being conducted by the United States in their home countries, whether it's a coup d'etat in Honduras or a legal coup in Peru or a coup in Ukraine or a war anywhere in Central Africa, North Africa, Middle East. You know, people are being driven out of their homes. You mentioned Yemen. You know, have 9 million people that are, you know, two glasses of water away from death. People come here, you know, in an emergency created by the U.S. government. And rather than the U.S. government solving it by, A, stopping the destruction of their countries and remediating the situation in their country, and B, rationalizing immigration, which should have been done generations ago, we have this situation where there's constant tension that undermines labor markets, that leaves the people who come here in a precarious legal situation so they can be carted away at a moment's notice. Not exactly the kind of environment you want to create for anybody in your country, because it means they can create it for you. It's a benefit to the elite all the way around. They get to blow up anybody they want and then do what they'd like with what shakes out of it.
You know, It all gets down to one really simple equation here. It's the politics of your zip code. You're absolutely right, Don. All of the effects of these illegal, immoral wars, they're not even wars because nothing is ever won.
Right.
The only thing that ever happens is destruction and misery. And people want to escape it. They go to Europe. Europe is having a really big problem grappling with it. It's happening to the United States. And it's when you live in a privileged zip code, well, none of those negative effects ever impact you, do they?
Right.
Okay?
That's right.
You never see it. Maybe you'll get a Honduran nanny to take care of your child, okay? Maybe
right.
That's it, okay?
That's right.
But, you know, or in some cases in near the southern border, agricultural workers. But for the rest of the people, they have to absorb the consequences of what the elites do.
Right.
Because, yes, war is a very, very profitable thing. John McCain, what was the arms maker that wrote the obituary for John McCain that was a real flop? I don't remember which
one of the like McDonnell Douglas, one of the big
ones. One of the big evil ones, and they just said the truth. You know, they basically said you made a lot of money for us, John. We're gonna miss you.
Yep.
Okay, I mean, really.
Yeah, well, meanwhile, while you're on that topic, there's
oh no! Here we go.
I saw this first. I saw it just go by, not from RT reporting on it, but the actual piece. That a column in the Washington Post that claimed that McCain was a human rights champion, and in particular, he was a champion of minority rights, and illustrating the picture, they had him with Oleg Tanabuk, who from Svoboda, an actual neo-Nazi. He's standing next to a neo-Nazi as a hero of human rights, and this is a neo-Nazi he'll put in power.
You know, the whole death saga of John McCain, I more or less abstained because I have certain principles. I'm not going to spit on a dead man, okay? John McCain was simply an awful person, an awful politician, and his impact was so negative, it's hard to even comprehend one person could do that. But I'm not going to get into the parade of, you know, he should burn in hell and all this. You know, I just refuse to do that. Just look at the record, and I'm glad you brought up that picture, because it's people like us that point out what the picture actually is about, okay? And that's what we need to do. We don't need to go around pissing on his grave. We need to say, you see what he illegally went into Syria. He was had himself photographed with people that were the specific people he was photographed with were involved in kidnapping Shia, not Sunni, citizens of Syria, and who knows what they were doing to them after they were kidnapped. So this is the kind of human rights advocate that John McCain was. But the thing is that when you look at, you know, from Fox all the way to MSNBC, this kabuki theater about John McCain was just sickening to me.
Yeah,
it's really sickening, and it's a reflection again. We're, you know, are you for Trump, against Trump?
I mean, exactly.
Mantra here.
It's
really about who we are as a nation and what we're willing to accept in the name of these elites that do things that Americans are barely aware of what's done in their name. And John McCain was the flag bearer for the worst parts of American hegemony in his time in high politics.
Yeah, this one. Here's a tweet that somebody
he's
names.
He's a hero. I mean, really.
Afghanistan, Bosnia, Honduras, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, North Korea, Serbia, Sudan, Syria, Russia, Ukraine.
Yep.
McCain on the wrong side of all of them from the human rights perspective.
Yeah, but you have to see. This is what makes the U.S. public sphere akin to Pol Pot. You have to nod your head and say yes.
Right.
You must do it, or there'll be consequences.
Yeah.
That's what it is. There's an authoritarian mindset already so well established in the public sphere, where I know I've had, and I will keep them for my memoirs. I will I will cross out the names of people that have written me messages that they no longer can appear on Crosstalk because of the consequences they would face at work. Okay, and a number of really really great people, and they wrote in great detail. And I'm the type of person who would never release that to the public. I would redact their name maybe in the future to make sure no one knew what their identity was. But this is the kind of atmosphere. If there's a legacy for John McCain, that's it. Yeah. The authoritarian groupthink about foreign policy and America's role in the world today. That's his legacy.
Yeah. And you got, meanwhile, again, the Washington Post, Max Boot today.
Oh, great.
Republicans rejected McCain and embraced Trump. What does that say about them? And for me, it actually makes me want to reevaluate them and say, hey, maybe they're not so bad after all.
Well, the thing is that, again, I mean, John McCain, see, we play around with these ridiculous labels, Democrat, Republican. The further you go up the pecking order, there's no difference among
kidding.
Them, okay?
Yep.
Really.
Yep.
And this is kabuki theater, you know. That's what it is. I mean, Max Boot has the amazing living legacy of being wrong about everything that he's ever said professionally.
That's
yeah.
True.
He is on the top of the pantheon there. He's number one. I mean, he's got the gold medal. He's got the Oscar for having the worst crystal ball in American foreign policy. Congrats, Max.
Yeah. Nice work. There should be an award for that somewhere. So meanwhile, with some of the things that are going on around the world, I assume you've been watching them for when you get back to work on, I guess, tomorrow, right? The 30th is
your...
Yep. What are we looking at with Crosstalk when you jump back into the saddle?
Well, a couple of days ago, we had Macron of France, and you had, I think, the German defense minister coming out saying they have to start reassessing the security relationship with the United States, something I've been predicting for a long time with the advent of Trump. I want to mull that a bit. A little bit about John McCain's legacy. I've been very interested in what's been going on in South Africa recently. I'm very glad that the South African government is backtracking on the seizure of lands without compensation, primarily of white farmers. I think that, you know, we have the left in America is an abdication of responsibility. And I remember the apartheid movement very, very well. I was a student at UC Davis. That was our issue. And I agreed with it, okay, because I believe in protecting minorities and not defining everything through race, okay? And now we have a government in South Africa that is betraying that completely. And Western media is just loath to point it out. But just enough people did. I did over at the Duran with my colleagues there. And I think that collectively, the people on YouTube, we kind of moved the needle because it's just wrong. I mean, that is what is being done to African Boer farmers is racism. And just say it. I know it's uncomfortable for people of the left to say that about South Africa, but it is not the rainbow nation that their propaganda wants to say it is, okay? It's a very, very complicated thing, and I've made it very clear that there's the legal concept of eminent domain. If a political decision is made to seize these lands, they must be compensated at market value. If it's so important as a political imperative, there are ways of doing it. Don't kill them. Don't run them off the land. We all know that's wrong. The ultimate implications for South Africa is horrendous. Without the rule of law, there will not be foreign investment. No one will want to buy those farms because you'll lose it because there's no rule of law. These farms are very heavily indebted into banks. The banking system could take a major hit. And that's on top of all the other problems that South Africa has. I hope that the left would think this one through, okay?
I'm just wondering...
I'm called a racist by some people on YouTube for saying what I just said.
I understand why that sounds like that to some people because they don't understand much about the actual situation in South Africa. Because the political situation, for example, isn't even that clear. This isn't the ANC that's advocating this, okay? And the ANC...
Well, there are elements of the ANC, and it has come
the
from
youth,
that.
The
and,
youth.
And their allies, okay? I'm not going to let the ANC off the hook on this.
I'm not talking about who's on the hook and who's not. You have... Here's the situation, and I don't know if we have enough time to go through this whole subject really fairly, but the situation is such that it's something that exists around the world in a post-colonial world where the colonial powers and their heirs who remain end up with, they stole the wealth at the beginning of the colonial period and they gave it to their own. And
Don, the ownership issue is extremely complicated. In some cases, it was just settlers where no one made a claim to the land. In some cases, land was bought. There are documents of this. In some cases, land was taken through force. But the point is, and some of that land that was taken through force has been returned, okay? But African tribes took land from other African tribes through the use of force. So we need the rule of law. You just can't say it was stolen. That's not good enough.
We're going to have to come back.
We need to have the rule of law and to adjudicate it in a fair way where everyone's interests are recognized, respected, and adjudicated. And it can be done. But you don't need this blind ideology. They just stole the land and they're white. That is a recipe for disaster for South Africa.
And that's
these farmers, 9% of these farmers feed South Africa. They feed South Africa. You take them away, you have Zimbabwe.
Okay, now.
And I'm not trying to favor anyone over another. I'm looking at South Africa as a whole because you want a refugee crisis. You need international food aid going into a country that actually can produce large amounts of food. We don't need this reckless behavior. It needs to be thought out. And I know it's a really special issue for some members of the government, some members of the ANC and others. It does whip people up into a fury. But it's not going to solve South Africa's problems.
And I would really like to get into this, maybe do a whole piece about it. I am not advocating, certainly, anything that would end up destroying the agricultural sector in South Africa, which would be suicide for those people and for anyone, for the world markets or tanking the banks or anything else. And as a matter of fact, coming to the question of land ownership, I'm speaking in my area of expertise over the 40-some-odd years I spent in the title insurance business, and I know you have great expertise in terms of finance, and I think we'd have a very interesting conversation about it.
Let's do that,
because we're out of time. We'll do that next time we speak.
We just have to recognize and respect everyone's interests.
Absolutely true. I agree. Okay, Peter, thank you so much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. For much of the 20th century, rising levels of urbanization came hand in hand with rising incomes. Moving to a big city more often than not meant a ticket to a better life. That still holds true, but not everywhere. The majority of people living for big cities in the global south, particularly in Africa, may actually see their fortunes worsened rather than improved. Is urbanization turning from a blessing into a curse? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Robert Buckley, Senior Fellow in International Affairs at the New School in New York. Mr. Buckley, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, almost every country in the world has its version of the Breakfast at Tiffany's movie about young men or young women moving into a big city attracted by its opportunities. But I understand it from your writing that it is a rather mythologized perception of what urbanization is like. More and more people are moving to bigger cities, not because they want to, not because they are attracted by its big lights, but because they have no choice. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Now, let me qualify that. That it's not The general phenomena, or how it's thought of, is that indeed cities grow more rapidly and urbanization happens as incomes increase. And so in some countries, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, we've witnessed a phenomenon in which people move to cities because the conditions in the countryside are deteriorating, either conflict or drought. And so they're moving to cities in a situation where their income isn't increasing. But that doesn't mean their situation isn't improving relative to where they were. They were in dire straits in the countryside and came to the city. So urbanization is not correlated with increases in income, but it doesn't mean that it's causing their situation to deteriorate.
I heard you say that many cities are now not prepared for the kind of influx of new residents, and they're planning, making planning changes only after the occupants have arrived, rather than before, as was the case with, let's say, New York or Barcelona in the 19th century. And that, in your view, leads to the proliferation of slums. I wonder if you consider slums a kind of cities in the broad sense of the word.
I think the sense of kind of the mythologies of how urbanization fits into an economy was generally the notion that as urbanization increases, societies become richer, and that people coming to cities would often come, particularly poorer people, and stay in a slum as a way station on their way to becoming integrated into the city. But now we're finding that in many African countries, this is the third generation of families living in the same slum, and they're not integrating into the society. And slums are increasingly, according to UN data, in most African cities, it's a majority of the population indeed lives in slums without sanitation facilities and often without clean water.
You said before that moving into a bigger city does not necessarily mean that, doesn't mean at all that your life fortunes are going to worsen, but I think, at least here in Russia, we associate living in a city with higher living standards than in the countryside, higher levels of hygiene, higher levels of healthcare. But from what I understand, living in a very high dense communities like slums without proper access to healthcare, or sometimes with no access to healthcare at all, would actually increase your likelihood of contracting diseases.
Sure.
Is that, do we understand at this point how those communities even function? How do they address those kind of challenges?
Not extremely well. And for example, one of the issues that I paid a considerable amount of attention to is the provision of sanitation. And one reason I did is that in sub-Saharan Africa for the past 25 years, which has probably been their most rapid period of economic growth, there's been almost no improvement in access to urban sanitation, and it's 40% of the population has access. So when you have figures that low, the evidence suggests that no one benefits from the provision. If you increase from 40 to 42, no one benefits because you still have people defecating in alleys and you still have feces everywhere. And so the sense of the health effects of something like that could be extraordinary. And then if you compound that with many African cities are in dire straits already, and their urbanization rates are at some of the highest levels ever. So you're compounding a problem that's already severe with an influx that could create nothing short of a catastrophe, I think.
Well, I think in one of your videos you did describe it as a looming catastrophe on our hands. Do you think the world community at large is well aware of what's going on?
No, I don't think.
Why not?
I don't know. I think there is attention to it, but I think things like sanitation, it's not a topic that a government official wants to discuss. It's not something that you don't get a lot of ribbon cuttings for opening up a new sewer system, you know, that you would with redesigning the Bolshoi or something like that. That's one conjecture about why that's the case, but frankly, I don't know. But there is, and don't let me overstate it, there is attention to it, but I don't think the resources correspond to the need.
The argument that is often used to persuade donor countries to provide resources for that kind of effort is the fear of migration. If you don't want people coming into your cities, you need to spend some money on making their lives more livable. Do you think that is a persuasive argument?
No, and it's one that, as you say, it's I think a myth that's been held by many officials and public officials and in the international agencies, that the sense that you can prevent people from coming to the cities. I know in some countries they in fact subsidize people to take a bus back to the countryside, and they get on the bus and they go back and visit their relatives and then come back to the city. And so it goes to my earlier point, and the way you articulated it, it is the cities throughout history have offered bright lights and learning and occupations. Cities are a great thing, and it's just how do you deal with this demographic movement has always been a difficult process, but I think right now in some countries it's a particularly difficult process.
I heard you say that almost all of the world's next 2 billion people will live in these already Islam-saturated communities. Given the scope of the problems already, do you think the problem of slums will ever be resolved? Is that even possible given where we are at this point of time?
Well, I'm of two minds. I think, there's a joke in economics where people say this is unsustainable, and if it's unsustainable, it indeed will stop. And so I think given the potential problems here, you could get people not moving to cities at nearly the rate that has been anticipated. You could get a reaction from government. And so economists tend to be cynical, and they tend to believe that in the long run things work out. And so that's one view, but I think there's a need to prompt people to react to this so that you react before the problems occur.
But, the problem of migration, especially from the sub-Saharan Africa, is, I think, has been in the making for over a decade. I mean, it precedes the wars in sure. Libya and in Syria. And if you think about billions of people moving to very Europe. Poor conditions. Regardless of whether you provide sanitation there or not, it seems that the only way out of that situation is to build more housing there, but actually to
more economic growth. Yeah. You see the thousands dying crossing the Mediterranean into Europe, and the world probably hasn't had this many migrants in 50 years since World War II. It is an incredible situation, and that we see a lot of the news about international migration, but the same thing is going on within countries, and there's rapid movement to cities and the same kind of phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Now, you alluded to the fact that not many politicians or policymakers are very keen to address that problem, or perhaps do not take it as the first priority. And there is, I think, a very romantic view in certain urban circles that cities will find solutions to all the world's problems. It's cities, not nation states, that will do that. Do you subscribe to that point of view?
So I don't think they can. I think cities have been far more innovative than national governments, and I do think there's a sense in which cities are becoming politically more important, and the ideas that are been generated in the world are, I think so much of our culture and ideas come from cities, and it comes from just as one writer, Jane Jacobs, talked about the only place where you can see strange events are either by travel or by going to a city. And so there's just so much going on that ideas are generated. And so cities, are a fulcrum of change like that. But nevertheless, central governments are still important and very important in terms of addressing larger issues like income distribution and climate change.
You know, what makes me concerned about this kind of discourse is the fact that we have long seen a gap between politics and policies. And, ideally politics is supposed to be a facilitator of policies, but I think they're increasingly diverging, especially in the Western countries. And my concern is that if we think this way of cities, leading the way, we will essentially leave all the major issues of life, of war and peace, of life and death, to the politicians. Do you have that sense? And I wonder if you believe that politicians care enough about the things that you supposedly care.
I think there's an awful lot of politicians talking about ideas that are clearly not only not evidence-based, but based on against evidence. And that to me is I don't fully understand, but I do observe it a lot, and I it's quite distressing, and I don't know how to explain it, but it's a real danger. And I think measures to enact policies that are shown to not be effective create political value in some way is quite peculiar.
I don't want to make this interview political. It's strictly about the cities, but we're obviously recording it at a time when there is a major fear of a confrontation between our countries, between the United States and Russia over Syria. And, you know, it just strikes me that so much attention is paid to delivering a strike on a country, whereas, as you say, we have millions, possibly even billions of people living in squalid conditions, and nobody ever would even discuss that on television. How often do you get a chance to talk about things that worry you?
So I think there's an active discussion. It's just there's not much action. So that's kind of depressing. And there's a lot of action on, as I said, things that are clearly not only not evidence-based, but against the evidence. There's a famous old conservative economist, Milton Friedman, who said that economists' role are to provide the information, then people make the right choice. What we see today is something quite different than that. Information is provided and actions are taken that have very little to do, or in fact are the opposite of it.
Well, Mr. Buckley, we have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Robert Buckley, Senior Fellow in International Affairs at the New School in New York. Mr. Buckley, just to finish the issue of where politicians put their attention to, Syria is a lot... is on my mind a lot. And I think there's also something, you know, that country also requires an urgent help of specialists like yourself, because it has lots of formerly urban communities where the infrastructure was damaged a great deal. Some of those communities are now trying to go back to normal, but obviously the resources are lacking or very short. I wonder if we understand as a global community at this point how to try to rebuild those cities, not only Syria, but perhaps also in Iraq, in a way that would encourage reconciliation between various ethnic groups rather than strengthen the divisions that provoked those conflicts in the first place.
There's a famous English economist, Lord Keynes, who said economists' aspiration should be to be like dentists and to say we can repair this tooth. And so in terms of working on cities, you have to have a context that the environment, the broader political environment, is reasonable and that people can that politicians will be responding to the people. When you have a state of war, there's nothing I can do with my minor skills about how a city works to deal with that.
I'm not suggesting that you should go to Syria and try to rebuild it from the ruins. I'm just asking whether it is even possible to carry out something on that scale that has already, to rebuild something on the scale that we have in Syria.
I think we've had, if you go through history, mankind has been cruel and destructive over and over again, and somehow our cities have come back, and many are quite beautiful and wonderful places. If you look in the Middle East and places like Syria, it's. I agree with you, it's totally depressing, and I wish that the political issues involved with it could be resolved. I don't begin to understand it or how to do that, but I think until that is done, there's very little hope that those cities will be able to turn the tide. I think it has to come from the broader political context rather than from the city context up.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I understand that you specialize in sort of matching or correlating the city's layout, its morphology, to the economic activity. And we have an interesting example here in Russia of the Chechnya's capital, Grozny, which was destroyed two decades ago, which has now been rebuilt with heavy federal subsidies. But I think there is a mismatch between how the city looks and how it operates in terms of the organic, self-sustaining growth. I mean, if you have the money, you can give it and the city will exist. But the question is of how you make it self-sustaining. Have you figured out how to do the latter part? What does it require?
So we just did some work, what we refer to as trying to avoid what they call the Ozymandias syndrome. And Ozymandias is this man who thought he was the king of kings and had a statue built of himself that said, "All ye who look on me despair because I have such a beautiful place that I've designed, and it's in fact in the middle of a desert." Building a city is a very organic spatial structure that responds to economic incentives, and it's impossible for one planner to know how to allocate and make the investments for the entire city. I think, as you mentioned earlier, in New York and Barcelona, the plans there, and what they did was quite basic in terms of set up a structure so that people can respond to the incentives and build. And Paris and places like that, that they're as Paris is the city of lights still. It's still quite beautiful. And building a city that organically responds to the incentives and structures, long-lived structures that can take advantage of where people want to live, how they want to live, and so forth, is unquestionably the most important thing to do. So a public policymaker to assume that he or she could do that is hubris of the highest degree and almost certain to fail.
Now, I know that you've also studied the morphology of Russia's largest agglomerations, 13 largest cities in Russia, and you suggest that its morphology is less than optimal in terms of encouraging economic growth. What do you see as the major impediments?
So let me qualify that in a couple of ways. First of all, I haven't been to Russia in 18 years. I worked here during the transition, and now I've come back, and it's delightful to be back and meet many old friends and just Russian people who are so friendly to me. And so my investigation was with the co-author, who in fact is my son, and he's a geographer who worked through satellite images of Russian cities. And what we did was compare those images to what cities look like around the world. And what we find is that the types of structures of the cities, the density of the population is such that it's unusual. It's very unusual. And so papers written during the transition suggest that was quite costly to the Russian economy and was one of the reasons that the government was seeking to reform the way cities functioned. What we found is that those patterns seem to not only persist, but in some places to intensify. So 25 years after the reform, you still have cities where instead of having most of the people living in the center of the city, you often have most of them living on the outskirts of the city. And so the idea of a city is that people get together and they congregate and they exchange ideas.
It's the idea of the Western city, but I guess for us, the Russians, that kind of morphology reflects, you know, something deeper about our culture. We are very centralized people with some authoritarian tendencies. So I wonder if that layout is ultimately a good reflection of not only our city planning, but also of broader things in our culture.
No, could, as we say in the paper, you know, number one, we're not sure it matters that it's different. And if it does matter, we're not sure that it's as costly as it could be. But if you look at the studies in America about these kinds of distortions, they matter. They matter a lot. And they've, you know, some estimates are that they've reduced economic growth in the United States by 50%. And so it's the ability to move to cities that have the highest productivity. If you can't move and you can't move to the places within those cities that afford you the opportunity to exploit your skills, it stands to reason that you'll be less productive. Whether that matters on a broader scale or whether it's something cultural, we don't know. We're just reporting that it is different here and asked Russians to say, do they agree? Do they think what the causes are that we think and what can be done about it? And what can be done about it is a quite difficult question.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also attribute that to a anti-commons problem, which you describe as too many people having too many rights to control a property, which makes a consensus very difficult. And I think part of the reason is also that the Russian people, after a long history of collective existence, have also become very automized, and they avoid collective solutions, collective action, even if it's objectively to their benefit. Is that something permanent, or do you think that may change over time? Have we seen in other cities how this collective muscle, collective in a positive way, how does it form?
So that was one of yesterday I gave this presentation, and four Russian experts responded, and then people from the audience responded, and that was almost a continual theme, that it's not only the difficulty of negotiating, it's the lack of desire to do so, and that while the buildings, the units were privatized, many people don't feel that the building has anything to, they have anything to do with, and that they should, that should be provided to them. And so one commenter said they're not real owners. They view themselves as residents, and there is this very collective feeling. And so that's something that I think is profoundly difficult to change, and it'll take time. I also think that in terms of the transition, that some people, take for example a person living on the outskirts of Omsk, for example, quite a distance from a job, who has transport heavily subsidized, utilities heavily subsidized, and not many job opportunities there now, or not as many as there were in the old days. What does that person do? If you think of the house they've been given, if you put the real cost to the utilities, their opportunities, and their transport, in fact, they weren't given an asset. They were given something that detracts from their wealth. And so that person's in a tough spot. And so lots of Russians, I think, are in that spot. And it makes it a very profoundly difficult political question.
It's an interesting observation, especially given that our authorities like to complain about the lack of social mobility on the part of the population. But you can also, I guess, think about the policies that would encourage that social mobility by, for example, restructuring some of those subsidies or helping people to make rational decisions about their property.
Well, I think they are making rational decisions, and it's difficult for the government to move away from subsidizing the transport or the utilities simply because those people are in such a costly spot and they can't afford it, particularly the pensioners. What do you do about that? And that's just the transition from one type of system to another. It's a very costly change. This effect is one that I don't think is, and from the discussion yesterday, people were saying this is something we need to look at more closely.
Now, you mentioned that you haven't been to Moscow in quite some time, and I'm sure you've noticed that the Moscow authorities have put a lot of thought, a lot of resources in various beautification projects. They really try now to make the city environment a little bit more hospitable. But I think an interesting phenomenon here is that many of the residents are not actually excited about that kind of innovation. And what it also reveals is the lack of skill of communication on the part of the authorities, or perhaps on the part of the population. Is that a particular Russian phenomenon, or is this something that you see in other cities as well?
I'm not sure. I guess I should say that I find the city I've only had walked around the center here, but it's quite lovely, and it's not what it was when I was here when the transition was going on. It's now a European city. It feels a little idiosyncratically Russian, I guess, but it's delightful. And it's so to me, as an external observer and the person who goes to lots of cities, it's great to come back, and the people are very warm, and it's just been a delightful experience.
Mm-hmm. But you're speaking on a personal level,
yes.
And I guess my question is more professional in alludes to more of
sure.
your professional expertise. I think the idea that the Moscow authorities have is that if you create the right kind of environment, that will help to bring more people into the city, not only tourists, but also more businesses. It will also help keep the most educated within the city. Do you think that kind of rationale is going to work, especially given the kind of times that we live in?
So what I think, this is a fascinating historical moment, and it reminds me of New York when there was a man named Robert Moses who They say that he's the only man in the 20th century who you can, from the moon, see his creations on Earth. And he really carved up New York City. And he built a lot of it. He built Lincoln Center. He did a lot with Central Park. But he also destroyed a lot. And he destroyed and he cut through neighborhoods, particularly poor neighborhoods, and avoided the rich neighborhoods. And so his movement of restructuring a city, you know, for better or worse, Moscow's in a point where it needs to restructure. And so how you do those things when you have all the millions and millions of people who have different ideas, you have to listen to them. And I think the antidote to Robert Moses was a woman named Jane Jacobs and very much getting community participation. But that slows things down a lot. And you can understand when there's a need for change, why people don't want to engage the community. But nevertheless, if you don't, it doesn't work. And so I think it's a very difficult time, and I don't begin to second-guess the things that have been done, but I wish them well.
Well, Mr. Buckley, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been delightful. I appreciate your time. And I also encourage our viewers to keep it going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.